News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. Journalist and historian Rick Atkinson says to begin to understand the victory of the Allied forces in Europe in World War II, one must become a student of the campaign in North Africa. He says while it was a pivotal time, it is seldom included in histories of the war. He says it was pivotal in terms of the outcome of the war and of America's place in the world after the war. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Rick Atkinson is our guest in this portion of the program. He is the author of the new book, An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942-1943. The book is the first in Atkinson's planned liberation trilogy of the Second World War. Of the war in North Africa, Atkinson says it was the place where the U.S. began to act like a world power. It was the place where the enemy lost the initiative in the war. And it was where Great Britain fell into the role of junior partner in the Anglo-American alliance. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Rick Atkinson is on leave from the Washington Post, where he most recently served as assistant editor for investigations. He's the recipient of several honors. His awards include the 1982 Pulitzer for National Reporting and the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service, awarded to the Post for a series he spearheaded on shootings by the District of Columbia Police Department. In addition to An Army at Dawn, he's the author of The Long Gray Line, a book about the West Point class of 1966, and Crusade, a book about the Persian Gulf War. Rick Atkinson, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. The book opens with this sentence, 27 acres of headstones fill the American military cemetery at Carthage, Tunisia. How many men are buried there, Rick?
Well, there are about 2,400 men, approximately. The American soldiers who fell in North Africa are buried there for the most part. The American military, unlike the British, tends to group the soldiers together in one large cemetery in the theater. The British are buried in smaller cemeteries where they fell. And at the end of the war, the survivors of those who were killed had the option of either having their boys brought home or having them buried, in this case, in North Africa. And you find about 40% of those who were killed buried in the theaters.
Hmm. How many British and French forces died there? And what about the casualties among the Axis powers?
Well, there were 70,000 Allied casualties altogether in the campaign in North Africa, which began on November 8, 1942, almost exactly 60 years ago, with the invasion of Morocco and Algeria by British and American forces. And it ended in May of 1943. So 70,000 Allied casualties, about 20,000 of those were Americans. The rest were divided between the British and the French, who initially had fought us. Most Americans, I think, don't know that for the first 3 days of our effort to liberate Europe, we fought our oldest friends, the French. And the French, after some pretty bloody fighting during those 3 days, eventually switched sides and joined the Allies. They came back onto the side of the Angels. The Axis casualties are estimated at about 300,000. and that includes about 250,000 German and Italian men who were captured. Hitler made the decision as the campaign came toward an end in May of 1943 that he was not going to try to evacuate North Africa. He had them stand and fight. They stood and they fought, and for the most part they were captured or killed.
Hmm. You describe what the battlefields of Tunisia look like today in the book. Have you been there?
Yes, I've been there twice, in fact. I think it's important to go for a couple of reasons. One, the very issue you raised a moment ago, to go to the cemeteries. The dead, I think, speak to you if you listen and you meditate on what they have to say. And it's all a part and parcel of my effort to remember who they are and to understand who they were. And then it's also important to go to the battlefields because even if you're not a professional tactician, you get a feel for the land in ways that's pretty fundamental and is important beyond what you can get from maps or even reading descriptions of it. You understand the vulnerable low ground and the superior high ground, and you can see why certain things unfolded as they did, and you see that topography is fate frequently. So, yes, I was in Tunisia twice. I was also in Morocco, where the American forces under George Patton landed on November 8, 1942. And there's nothing like going there to understand it better. And you find that in many cases the battlefields are largely undisturbed. You don't have urban encroachment in southern Tunisia at El Ghatar and Meknassi and these very remote places near Kasserine Pass. So you can find shell fragments, rusty sea ration cans. You find the foxholes and the trenches that were dug. It's kind of eerie, and again, it's important to understand what happened there, how it unfolded.
Why do most of us know so little about the war in North Africa?
Well, I think, Celeste, that Americans in particular have a view of World War II that consists of Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941, and then Normandy, which was, of course, June 6, 1944, and from Normandy until the end of the war. The Battle of the Bulge fits in there. And, you know, my belief is that you cannot really understand what happened in 1944 and 1945. You can't really understand the victory of the Allied forces in that last year of the war unless you understand what happened in 1942, 1943 in North Africa, and then in Sicily and Italy, which occurred in 43 and 44. Because that army that comes ashore at Omaha Beach and Utah Beach at Normandy really has a cumulative history. And more important, the men who make up that army, both the commanders and the ordinary foot soldiers, have a cumulative history. And understanding where they came from, what they had been through, is important to understand how we won the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to this pivotal moment in our history that we all remember, as you say, or we know about, Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941, the end of 1941, America suddenly in the war. Prior to that attack, the general attitude here about the war in Europe was stay out of it, right?
That's true. There was a strong streak of isolationism that was prevalent in the United States. I think most Americans knew by the time of Pearl Harbor that staying out of it was probably not going to happen. But certainly as the war drums had beat louder and louder in Europe leading up to the invasion of Poland in September 1939, which was the beginning of the war, there was an overwhelming sentiment in some parts of the country that this was just not going to be our war, that we needed to stay out of it, that we'd done our bit in World War I to try to keep the Western democracies from each other's throat. And as a consequence, we weren't very well prepared. I think it's amazing to recall that when the war began in September 39, the United States ranked 17th in the world in terms of the size and combat power of its army. We were right next to that perennial military powerhouse, Romania. And you find that in the American army, even of 1942, the period that we're talking about for North Africa, there wasn't a single American general who had commanded a unit as large as a division in World War I. So this is a very green army. It's an army that is in many ways not prepared to fight a global war against an enemy that's as formidable as the Germans. And there's a great ambivalence in the American people generally about what exactly we ought to be doing. Japan attacked us. Why aren't we fighting the Japanese? Well, we were fighting the Japanese to some extent. Guadalcanal had already begun in the South Pacific. But we're fighting in Europe because the strategic decision had been made by President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill of Germany first. Germany was clearly the most potent of the Axis adversaries. It had the greatest industrial capacity. It had the most ferocious land army. It had a very substantial air force. So the belief was if you could defeat the Germans first, then the rest of the Axis would fall naturally afterwards. And that's why we're looking to find a place in Europe, or in this case, North Africa, to fight.
Yeah. The U.S. at the outset wanted to go right into Europe, but the British were adamant that they did not want to land in France and begin marching on to Berlin. What was their stand on that? Why were they so adamant about that?
Well, that's exactly right. They were adamant. The American impulse, really, and it was articulated most forcefully by the Chief of Staff of the Army, George Marshall, and almost all the rest of the military brain trust in the American Armed Forces stood shoulder to shoulder with him on this, was to go right for the jugular. If you're going to defeat the Germans, then lunge straight for Berlin, cross the English Channel, go into France or somewhere on the coast, and head right for Berlin. The British, having been at war at this point, and this argument is going on really into the summer of 1942, the British have been fighting for well over 2 years. They knew how ferocious the Germans were. They had been kicked out of Europe on several occasions already in the war, including at Dunkirk. And so the British impulse was to say, wait a minute, you don't appreciate how formidable the Germans are, that they've got 25 divisions in France alone. If we go across the Channel, there's a good chance that we'll either be repulsed on the beaches and slaughtered there, or we'll be bottled up and not be able to go anywhere. Churchill persuaded Roosevelt over the course of several months that it would be better to have the American army enter into the war against a less formidable foe than the German army in France. And he also persuaded President Roosevelt that there was a lot of sense to opening up the Mediterranean. If you could control North Africa, you controlled the Mediterranean. That gave you access to Suez. You didn't have to sail all the way around Africa to get to India and the Far East. President Roosevelt listened to these arguments. They got to be quite bitter and basically decided against the advice of virtually all of his uniformed military commanders to side with the British. And he announced in July of 1942, we're going to North Africa. When he sent down this decree, he signed it Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Commander-in-Chief, so there would be no doubt about what authority he was using to make this decree.
Well, that's July 42, but then I found this amazing. A War Department message late August 42 proposed that, quote, the Middle East should be held if possible, but its loss might prove to be a blessing in disguise by giving the British their comeuppance and bringing them to their senses.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? This shows you how deep the rancor was over this argument. That is our War Department, the American War Department, writing a memo about the British, and in essence saying, well, if our closest allies, our dearest friends in this war, get their noses bloodied and end up losing the Middle East, well, it serves them right. It shows you exactly, on one hand, how deep the feelings ran, and it shows you also a certain immaturity about American strategic thinking at a certain level. This is not the way a great power should be thinking about grand strategy. Now, this isn't written by George Marshall, but it is reflective of a pretty substantial point of view within the War Department. And it also shows you how far we have to go in terms of solidifying our relationship with the British, which at this point, 1942, is really quite shaky.
It also shows how strategic interests can change
Yes.
Pretty quickly.
That's true, and there was a great suspicion in the American High Command, with some validity, that the British really had imperial designs, that they had imperial interests that were not necessarily our interests. The British Empire had, for 200 years, used the Mediterranean as a kind of British lake. They obviously had colonial interests in India and in the Far East, and there was a belief that what the British really wanted in terms of pursuing this Mediterranean strategy was to ensure that when the war ended, they reasserted themselves in these places where they had been strong before 1939. Mm. There's something to that. It's clear that Churchill was of a mind to try to recoup what the British had lost. On the other hand, there were legitimate strategic reasons that had more to do with winning the war, and Roosevelt, who was certainly nobody's fool, saw all of this and decided that despite their imperial ambitions and their interests that related to the British Empire, that this was still a good idea.
Yeah. You note that except for Britain, this tells you how Britain was fighting this war on its own until 42. Except for Britain and the neutral countries, Spain, Sweden, and Switzerland, all of Europe belonged to the Axis.
You know, if you look at a map in November 1942, when these invasion forces are about to descend on North Africa, you see swastikas everywhere. You're exactly right, except for Britain and except for those neutral countries. And there was a great deal of concern about Spain flipping sides and joining the Axis. It was a Nazi fiefdom.
Mm. This tells you how little I know about this war, ultimately. You know, I'm curious, how did Spain stay out of the war?
Well, Spain was headed by Francisco Franco, mm-hmm. dictator, who had won a very bloody civil war in 37-38, with help from the Germans, who used Spain as a testing ground for some of their new weapons. Franco recognized that Spain's long-term interests were probably better served by his staying out of this war. He knew that the British, first of all, were going to do everything they could to hang on to Gibraltar, which is on the southern tip of Spain. It commands the Straits of Gibraltar, the entrance into the Mediterranean. And even though he would like to have had Gibraltar back, and he would have liked to have had some other possessions that would have fallen into his hands probably had he joined the Axis, he played Hitler quite adroitly. Hitler met with Franco at one point to try to persuade him to join the Axis side, and Hitler afterwards said he'd rather have all of his teeth extracted than go through something like that again. Mm. So Spain watched, waited, and ultimately recognized that the Germans were probably not going to win and didn't have the leverage to force Spain into the Axis. They remained neutral for the rest of the war.
Mm. And what of Portugal?
Portugal was also neutral. Portugal was less important in the sense that it didn't have control over the Straits of Gibraltar, potentially. I think Lisbon in 1942 is really a nest of spies. You've got agents from all of the combatants working there. There's all kinds of skullduggery going on. But by virtue of the fact that it's encased by Spain on the Iberian Peninsula, and except for its border on the Atlantic, it's able to stay out of the war by virtue of the fact that it's kind of isolated.
Mm, interesting. Journalist and historian Rick Atkinson is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of the new book, An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942-1943. The book is the first in his planned liberation trilogy of the Second World War. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're invited to join us with your questions and comments. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The first campaign in North Africa was called Torch. Dwight Eisenhower was commander 60 years ago this month, November 1942. This was a huge gamble for the Allies. Why?
Well, it was a huge gamble for a couple of reasons. One, it required transporting 100,000 American and British soldiers from ports in the east coast of the United States and the west coast of Great Britain through German submarine-infested waters and depositing them on the beaches of Morocco and Algeria. In November 1942, the German U-boat threat, the submarine threat, was at its peak. There were hundreds of ships sunk in the summer and fall of 1942. So the notion of transporting all these men in a very vulnerable state on hundreds of ships meant a big risk had to be taken. It was a risk also because no one knew what the Vichy French, who controlled Algeria and Morocco and Tunisia, were going to do. There were great pains taken to try to persuade them to come on to the side of the Allies. There was great deception taken to persuade them that this was an all-American operation, that the British were not involved, because the British and the Vichy French had been at loggerheads for a couple of years. They detested one another. And so even the British soldiers who went ashore in Operation Torch during the invasion wore American flag armbands, all as a ruse to try to persuade the French that in the spirit of Lafayette they ought not fire on their oldest friends, the Americans. Mm. So it was really a great gamble. Some would argue, and I think with some merit, that it was the greatest strategic gamble that the Allies took in the war. And it was a gamble that paid off. It didn't work out exactly as they anticipated, because they thought that once they landed they would be able to swing into Tunisia, which is about 500 miles to the east of Algiers, with relative ease, and get there before the Germans and Italians could react. The Germans and Italians were not in North Africa at this time. Again, it's controlled by Vichy under the arrangement that Hitler had made with the French after he conquered France in the early summer of 1940. He allowed them to keep the bottom third of metropolitan France with a new capital in the spa town of Vichy, and allowed them to keep control of their colonies, including the three in North Africa that I mentioned, all as part of a pretty shrewd calculation by Hitler that he'd rather have the French be responsible for the 19 million people who lived in these North African colonies, most of whom were Arab and Berber, and it would have been an administrative headache for the Germans. So that's why Vichy is there. That's why the Vichy Army and Navy are there. And our calculation was wrong. They did fight. The Vichy Army fought not very enthusiastically. The Vichy Navy fought ferociously, and one of the great battles of the Atlantic War was fought off the coast of Casablanca on November 8, 1942.
Hmm. When did the Vichy French eventually come around and join the Allied forces in North Africa?
Well, those in North Africa who were under the command of an admiral named Darlan, who was really the number two man in the Vichy government. Vichy was headed by a World War I hero named Marshal Pétain. And Darlan happened to be in Algiers. His son was dying of polio in an Algiers hospital, and he happened to come from France and to be in Algiers when the invasion took place. And after this three-day period of fighting against the Americans and the British, Darlan recognized that he was overmatched. The Vichy forces in North Africa were poorly equipped. They were undermanned, and they were getting pounded by the Germans, by the Americans and the British. And so he essentially effected an armistice on November 11th after 3 days of fighting. The Vichy forces in metropolitan France, mainland France, basically repudiated this arrangement, and they held that their deal with Hitler was still in effect. Hitler brushed it aside. He sent his divisions sweeping through the rest of France, and so you find that by the third week of November, all of France, including that which had been controlled by Vichy, was now completely occupied by the Germans. And you find the French gradually swinging round to join the Allies, to pull themselves together militarily. And by the time we get to Italy in 1943, 1944, the French are a substantial fighting force, and they're an important part of the alliance.
Interesting. Let's talk with some listeners. First, we're going to go to a caller on the toll-free line, a listener in Casey. Good afternoon. Is there a caller there? Well, let's go on to another listener. A line one, a caller in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Yes, this is very interesting to me because my cousin, while we were like brother and sister, we were so close, and he was a pilot from a Martin Marauder, and that was at the time that we were fighting in North Africa. Now, whether U.S. forces were there, I don't know, but anyway, he was piloting his plane with a crew of five from northern Italy, I suppose, or wherever the American Air Force was, and he was shot down over the little island of Pantelleria. The Germans were in the boot of Italy, evidently, because that's where he was shot by the Germans, and he managed to get over North Africa, and we were told by the U.S. government that he got to Africa, North Africa, and managed to save his crew. They all got out, but when he bailed out, by that time the plane was too low, and he was killed when he hit the ground. But he did save his crew. I think there were four or five. I'm not sure. I can't believe how long it's been, because we were like brothers and sisters. And I'm 83. But, he was the only boy in our family, all girls. And so it was a terrible tragedy. And it really, his mother grieved so that she died in about a year. Well, anyway, now I'm getting to, you called the cemetery there, Carthage. When my husband and I were on a mission for USAID, I said, I'd like to go to that cemetery in Tunis. Well, so we got there we flew from Rome. We were en route to someplace else. And so, when we got there, we got a cab, and I knew a little bit of French, enough so that we could tell the taxi cab driver where we wanted to go. And I had called the Bureau of Graves and Monuments and knew exactly what my cousin Tom Johnson's, where he was, the cross and the casket were located in the North American Cemetery. We called it the Cemetery in Tunis. You called it Carthage, but that's probably the correct name. But anyway, the taxi driver took us right to the gate, and the gatekeeper came out, and I think he was a military man. I don't quite remember. He was stupefied. He said, "Oh, it's so good to see you. You are the first Americans who have been here in 9 months." I'll never forget it. And he took us right to he's like a brother, Tom's grave, Tom Johnson. And I just later felt, well, how many graves did you say were there? You spoke a number, I thought, I heard on the radio.
2,400 buried there.
400?
2,400.
2,400. And I thought it was a...
It's actually 2,841.
2,800.
Most of those are from the North African campaign.
What a waste. What a waste.
Yeah, well, that's a sad and stirring story. I'm surprised that the cemetery keeper said that there were very few Americans, because many make pilgrimages there. And I know when I've been there, there were other visitors, other Americans who were there. Pantelleria is a very interesting place. You're right. It's a small island. I think it's 25 acres or something like that. It's between Sicily and North Africa. It was considered by the Italians to be the Italian Gibraltar in terms of its impregnability. And it plays a substantial role between the end of the North African campaign in May of 1943 and the invasion of Sicily, which was July 10th, 1943, because Pantelleria basically had to be reduced. You couldn't allow this fortress to be in the way of the forces going to Sicily. And so there was an attack on it. It was the most heavily bombed place on Earth for a couple of weeks in the summer of 1943. And ultimately, the Italian garrison of 12,000 surrendered basically under bombing, and it gave the Allied forces, including General Eisenhower, who was their commander, really a wrong impression about what bombing could do. They came away from it believing that if you just kept pounding them enough from the air, an enemy would surrender, which in fact was true for the Italians on Pantelleria. It was certainly not true for the Germans almost anywhere else. And so Pantelleria, you know, for someone who gave his life to help capture Pantelleria, that's a noble cause.
Yeah. Also, I think the caller's comments speak to how the war in North Africa affected communities here in the States. There's a chapter in the book where you talk about Southwest Iowa.
Mm. Yes, it's true. One of the most interesting things to me in the campaign in North Africa is the 34th Infantry Division, which was the Iowa National Guard, with a regiment from the Minnesota National Guard, and they had been federalized in 1940, brought into the Army. They were the first American division sent overseas after Pearl Harbor. They began going to England in January 1942, only a month or so after Pearl Harbor. And because they were in England, where they were training, and they were not very well prepared for war, when the decision was made to go to North Africa, they were kind of available. And so you find the 34th Division in Tunisia when the great battle at Kasserine Pass begins on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1943, when Rommel attacks the Americans, thinking that he can sweep through them and push them back into Algeria and perhaps cut off the entire Anglo-American army. And you had entire companies which have been drawn from these little towns in southwest Iowa. Company M, in particular, from the 168th Infantry Regiment. Company M had come from Red Oak, Iowa. And the company was essentially obliterated. And the 168th Infantry was virtually obliterated. So you had, you know, a sizable proportion of the young men from these little towns suddenly gone, either captured or killed. And it was in North Africa with incidents like that, with catastrophes like that, that the war really began to come home to America. It had been somewhat distant before this. It was fought a long way away, but when towns in Iowa find out one morning that virtually all of the young boys that they had sent off to war months or a year or two before are gone, then you know you're at war, and you know you're at total war. And you're right, Celeste, this was really an important thing in the American wartime psyche.
Mm. Let's now talk with that listener in Casey on line 4, the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My congratulations to your guest. I'm quite impressed with his presentation, and I definitely guarantee he sold at least one copy of his book. You mentioned earlier the reluctance on the part of the Joint Chiefs or the United States government or military to support a landing else other than straight on or straight into France. you know, kind of a reminder here. Guadalcanal had happened 3 months before in, you know, July and August. That was the first really invasion of amphibious nature that the Americans had taken into war. And in combined with Dieppe later in August, there was no success at all really on the British side to support anything other than a move south into North Africa. At least that's how I have approached it.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. You're right. The notion of amphibious warfare was really pretty exotic and largely unknown, and the historical antecedents for it were not altogether reassuring. The British had the catastrophe of Gallipoli in World War I to draw on.
Right.
Guadalcanal had been a very bloody action. Dieppe was a mostly British and Canadian operation. It was a raid, really, in August of 1942 in this little town of Dieppe on the coast of France. It was a complete disaster. More than half of the men who were involved in it were either killed or captured. And so there was a lot of learning by doing when it came to amphibious warfare. And that's one of the reasons why North Africa is very important to the rest of the course of the war. We learned a lot of things.
Exactly.
In what was a pretty amateurish set of landings in Morocco and Algeria that were important and applied to the landings in Sicily, the landing at Salerno in Italy, the landings in southern France in August of 44, and of course the great landings in Normandy in June of 44.
Yeah, you referenced the experience that they gained through all of the Pacific landings and everything, and coming up to D-Day in Normandy, the learning curve was so vertical that the U.S. or the Allies of 1944 were, multitudes increased in experience and expertise in 2 years.
That's true, and you know, part of that, this is really a book about character. I'm interested in writing about war, not so much because I'm interested in battles per se or mm-hmm. in things that go bang, but because war is a tremendous refractor of character. It pulls apart the basic components of character the same way that a prism refracts light. And one of the things that's most important in this learning curve that you talk about is that the leaders in particular, leaders at all level, from platoon right up through Dwight Eisenhower commanding an army group, need the experience that North Africa provides to learn their craft, really. And it's a great sifting out occurs. You find out who is capable of command under the crushing responsibilities of combat and who is not capable of it. So there's a lot of things going on in North Africa that are very important for the rest of the war. It's where these fabulous characters first step onto center stage. Patton, Bradley, Eisenhower. It's where Montgomery makes his name. It's where Rommel really makes his name. And a whole lot of lesser lights who have been forgotten 60 years after the fact, who ought not be forgotten because they're, among other things, they're incredibly interesting people. And they're fabulous characters to me, not so much because they're flawless, they're not, but because they're deeply flawed. And part of what's happening here is overcoming the vicissitudes, the flaws, to rise to the occasion, to do what needs to be done.
Well, I look forward to your work, and congratulations on your preparation, if nothing else, sir.
Thanks very much for your call.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. I'm so glad we got into this territory, because that is something that really comes alive in this book, the characters. And maybe we could spend a little time, rather than going over what happened in the Kasserine Pass and some other battles in Tunisia in the winter of 43, and talk about some of the men, some of the characters that you capture on the page for this book. Let me throw out a few names and then pick one. Robert Moore, Kent Hewitt, Thomas Drake, Dwight Eisenhower.
Well, they're all fabulous names, and I would guess that your readers have only heard of Dwight Eisenhower of the four that
yep.
you mentioned. And let's take Kent Hewitt for a second. Henry Kent Hewitt, we see him as a rear admiral. He is the commander of Task Force 34, which is a collection of ships that is sailing from Norfolk and other ports in the United States, taking Patton's men, 34,000 men with Patton, to land in Morocco. Pretty much forgotten today. He's a large figure in the war. He's a major figure at Salerno and at Anzio in the Italian campaign. He's a wonderful character. He's very impressive looking. His uniform fits him kind of like blue rummage. He was said when he was a midshipman at the Naval Academy to have been so terrified of heights that he squeezed the tar out of the rigging in the sail loft. And yet you see this man who's unprepossessing in certain ways with a real grit. He won the Navy Cross in World War I. He's got an amazing knack for navigation. They talked about how these stars would eat from his hand. And he has the remarkable capacity to get along with George Patton, which is not easy because Patton is a very difficult character. He's highly suspicious of the Navy. He thinks that Hewitt, as they're getting close to Morocco, is going to turn around and run at the first sign of trouble, that the Navy will bolt when the shooting starts. And Hewitt, the book opens, in fact, with a meeting at the White House, a secret meeting in the third week of October 1942 between Hewitt and Patton and President Roosevelt, who has summoned the two of them to the White House. And so we see this relationship between Hewitt and Patton evolve, and we see Hewitt evolve. Here is a good example of a man who's largely unknown today, but is an important character and is really, a fascinating human being.
Yeah. I would think that your book could inspire many biographers to go out and to write some of these men's stories. Were you aware of Hewitt before you did the research for this book?
I only had the dimmest idea of who Hewitt was, and that's one of the great pleasures of doing something like this, is discovering people who are really forgotten. And, you know, I think the first duty is to remember, and we ought to remember who these men were. They're so important in our collective heritage. There's a guy named Terry Allen who's the commander of the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One, as we're going into Algeria in November 1942. Most people don't know who Terry Allen was, and he is a fantastic character. He is so larger than life. And his assistant division commander is a guy named Theodore Roosevelt Jr., President Teddy Roosevelt's son. And he's a fantastic character. You couldn't make him up. He's so improbable. and the sweep of the North African campaign is really just full of men like this.
Yeah. What proved to be the most valuable sources of information for you?
Well, some scholar has calculated that the entire archive of World War II records weighs collectively 14,000 tons. That's a lot, and it's pretty intimidating, but it's also an opportunity because no one has ever been able to look at more than just a small fraction of that 14,000 tons. There are things to discover. There are wonderful things to discover. World War II, like all of the greatest stories in human history, is fundamentally bottomless. And so you can find, I work at archives all over the country and all over the world. The big ones are the National Archives in Washington, the Library of Congress, the U.S. Army's Military History Institute at Carlisle, Pennsylvania, is where the Army keeps its unofficial records, its diaries and letters. Most divisions have a library or an archive of their own where they keep a lot of records and where they keep letters and diaries and things that have been left behind. The 34th Division in Iowa, for example, has an incredible little museum north of Des Moines. The 1st Infantry Division, the one that Terry Allen commanded, has a fabulous museum and archive just outside of Chicago in Cantigny. I spent a lot of time in London going through the Public Record Office and the Imperial War Museum, the Little Heart Center for Military Records. So if you dig hard enough, you can find things in almost any university library. There's at least some World War II archive. The issue is not, that there's not enough. The issue is that there's too much.
Yeah. Well, now you're embarked on a trilogy, three volumes. What comes next, and what's the third volume?
Well, the second volume, which will be published in 2005 or 2006, and which I'm working on now, will deal with the campaigns in Sicily and Italy. Those come chronologically after North Africa. And the third volume, which will appear 3 or 4 years after that, will begin on the eve of Normandy and carry us through to the end of the war. The war in Europe ends in May of 1945. The war in Europe, the liberation of Europe, is really a triptych. It's three panels that that inform one another. You have North Africa, then you have Italy, and then you have Western Europe. They're chronologically successive. Each of those periods lasts about the same period of time, particularly if Italy stops, as I plan to stop it in Volume 2, with the fall of Rome, which is June 4th, 1944, 2 days before Normandy. And again, I think you find that there's a cumulative effect. What was learned in North Africa, the people that emerge as capable leaders, those who fall by the wayside, all of that informs what happens in Sicily and Italy. The relationship between the Allies, the bickering, the animosity, the spats, all of it is carried along, swept on this great tide into the next campaign, into Italy, and then into Western Europe. And the characters, for the most part, go with us. The main characters, Eisenhower, Patton, Bradley, Rommel, Kesselring, the German commander in North Africa, is the German commander in Italy. We see him again in Western Europe. Montgomery, Alexander, the British field marshal. It's like a traveling road show. And so they're my confreres. I'm with them every day. I enjoy their company, and now we're together in Italy as I'm working on Volume 2.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. I appreciate it.
Rick Atkinson has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His book, An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942-1943, the first in his planned liberation trilogy of the Second World War, is published by Henry Holt. And that interview with Rick Atkinson was conducted on November 18th of 2002. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Soybeans gapped higher on the opening bell this morning on the Chicago Board of Trade, and they held that gap throughout the day, closing sharply up, double-digit increases in that soybean pit, while over in the nearbys in that corn pit, we did see some profit-taking in wheat finishing down on the day. Let's go ahead and get you caught up with the particulars. July wheat, a high on the day of 341. That had to be encouraging to the bulls, but it couldn't hold it. Low on the day of 328.5, settling 331.75, down 3.25 on the day. September, a high of 349.5, a low of 338, settling 342.25, down 2. December wheat, a high of 360, a low of 347.5, settling 350.25, down 4. March, a high of 363.5, a low of 358, settling 359.5, down 4.5. May, a high of 374, a low of 362, settling 363, down 3. July corn, a high of 227.5, a low of 219.75, settling 222 up 3/4. September, a high of 235.25, a low of 228.25, settling 230.75, up 1.25. December, a high of 245, a low of 237.25, settling 239.25, up 0.5. March, a high of 252.25, a low of 245.5, settling 247, up 0.25. May, a high of 255.5, a low of 250, settling 252, up 1. And the July contract, a high of 260.5, a low of 254.5, settling 256, up 0.5 on the day. July oats, a high of 138, a low of 133.75, settling 135.75, up 0.5. September, a high of 143.5, a low of 139.5, settling 143.25, up 3.75. July soybeans, a high of 686, a low of 672, settling 680 and a quarter, up 12 and a half. August, a high of 686, a low of 673, settling 681 and a half, up 12 and a half. September, a high of 685, a low of 674, settling 681, up 13 and a half. November, a high of 686, a low of 673 and a half, settling 682, up 14. January, a high of 684 and a half, a low of 674 and a half, settling 681 and a half, up 14. March, a high of 677, a low of 668, settling 674 and a half, up 9 3/4. July soybean meal, a high of 215.50, a low of 211, settling 214.70, up $6. August, a high of 215, a low of 211.40, settling 214.70, up $6 as well. July soybean oil, a high of 23.85, a low of 23.07, settling 23.15, down 11. August, a high of 23.90, a low of 23.17, settling 23.26, down 8 on the day. Remember to join us at 6 past the hour when we'll discuss these prices with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana, on the closing market report. Prices also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and it was a day of two trades, Celeste, where the cattle finish higher and the hogs finish lower.
Well, that's right. Let's find out what happened here this afternoon. August feeder cattle, they finished up 122.5 on the day. The high was 112.75, the low 110.80, the settlement 112.67.5. Again, that finishing up 122.5. September 111.50, the high 109.25, the low 111.42.5, the settlement that up 117.5. October 110.25, the high 108.75, the low 110.15, the settlement, that up 87.5. June live cattle 85.60, the high 84.80, the low 85.42.5, the settlement, that up 35. August 84.75, the high 83.80, the low, the settlement 84.70, that finishing up 62.5. As Dave mentioned, hogs and bellies finished lower today. June lean hog, 72.60 the high, 71.85 the low, 72 even the settlement, that down 25. July, 72.25 the high, 71.27.5 the low, 71.40 the settlement, that down 7.5. August, 70.60 the high, 69.50 the low, 70 even the settlement, that down 22.5. October lean hogs, they finished up a quarter today. 61.30 the high, 60.55 the low, 60.62.5 the settlement. Again, that up 25. And July belly, 73 even the high, 70.12.5 the low, 70.75 the settlement. That down 2.25. The Dow is off 36 points at 10,506. The NASDAQ off 3.